Hi, I'm Catherine Mangu Ward, Editor-in-Chief of Reason, and I'm talking today with Emily Oster. Emily is an economist at Brown University and the author of two books. Her first book, Expecting Better, was a cult hit among my friends. It was about how to use economics and social science to make good decisions during your pregnancy, including questions like, can I have a glass of wine sometimes? Answer is yes. Her new book, Crib Sheet, is for parents of children ages 0 to 3, and it uses the same methodology, consulting economics, social science, and other studies to see if there are good answers from good studies to the tough questions that face the parents of young children. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
I am want to start by saying that I am a big fan of your work and that I am also quite angry at you because you keep writing books that are just a couple years too late for my kids' ages.
No, I'm sorry. I can only write what I know. You should have waited.
I should have waited
and children.
Reproduced in sync with you because I'm right to say, yes, that you are writing these books essentially in line with the phases of development that your family is in. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. It is roughly right. I will say this new book is kind of 0 to 3, and my younger child turned 4 last weekend. So I feel like now, you know, I've got to do the next one. I've just aged out of the research that I did.
That's, but you probably got some advance copies of that book. So you were able to use some of it before you missed the mark. So I want to start just with a kind of a big picture question, which is, why are people so bad at understanding what scientific studies mean for their lives?
That is a big question. So I think there are a few different reasons. So I think one issue is that it can be very hard to distinguish between scientific studies that are good and scientific studies that are not good. And I think there is an increasing interest among many people in making life decisions based on evidence. So thinking, oh, I'm going to look at the scientific study and decide, you know, how to parent or what to eat or what kind of vitamins to take or whatever it is. But it can be very challenging to figure out what studies are good and what studies are not so good. And, you know, the media is, no offense, not always so helpful on this.
None taken.
Because I think that, you know, a lot of times studies get covered, evidence gets reported in a sort of uncritical way. And so then if you approach this as sort of like, I'm going to go on Google and I'm going to Google, you know, what should I do about this parenting thing? Even if you are just trying to look into studies, there are so many of them. And it is parsing through them is very challenging, which is sort of some of the work of my book. But I think that kind of overwhelming sense of there's so much out there. How do I know what's good and what's not good? Not all these things are created equal. I think that's at the core of some of these issues.
And you said there's an increasing interest in using empirical evidence to guide parenting and other life decisions. To what do you attribute that? And do you think that it will result overall in better decision making?
Oh, that's good. That's good. Do I think that's true? Why do I think that's true? I mean, I think that part of it is that the internet has made those things accessible to people in a way that they were not before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 25 years ago, if you wanted to read, you know, what studies were saying about some choice, you'd have to go to the library, find them in these journals. There's no Google. And so I think the advent of Google has made that possible in a way that it wasn't before. Do I think it helps people make better decisions? I would say broadly, yes, because often if you drill in, you will find that the studies that are the best, the really big studies that are the best, do kind of come out and people learn more about them and are able to make decisions based on them. So I think there is a sense in which, yes, it does help people make better decisions, but not always. I think it can sometimes lead to maybe too much reliance on evidence that isn't really there.
So let's do a case study, which you address in Crib Sheet, which is your new book. This, the question of SIDS. And you know, I think this is for the parent of a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. I am now outside of the window in which I had to go to war with all of the grandmothers about whether that baby was cold.
Now, maybe I shouldn't have gone to war. Should I have, you know, whisked all the blankets and bumpers out of my children's cribs, or no?
Yes. So when we study SIDS, I think that there's this is obviously a very hard thing to even think about and sort of talk about, because it is the thing that you fear the most as a parent. I think losing your child.
You just did such a good job of like bringing the "to be sure" empathy line in there. I really should have done that, man. I was like, hey, let's talk about dead babies. What does the data say?
So I think that is something that we all want to sort of do everything we can to prevent. And there are a lot of pieces of advice that have changed over time around this. And so one of them is things about having blankets in the crib. A related one is back sleeping, which I got a lot of pushback from my parents initially.
Right.
Because people used to put, the advice used to be not just that it wasn't a big deal to put them on the back, but explicitly to put your baby on their stomach. And that's sort of flipped around. And I think both of those pieces of advice are correct, in the sense that the data does support the recommendation to sleep, to have your baby sleep on the back. And it does support the recommendation not to have blankets in the crib, or not to have heavy blankets in the crib, you know, at the beginning. So I think all of these things become, as you say, as your kids get older, become less important. And so, you know, if your kid is two, they can have some stuffed animals in their crib. But for very small babies, yes, that advice is correct.
And what are the lessons to be learned from what I think is a success story in, you know, a new finding correctly disseminated across the relevant population without generating additional confusion? I mean, that actually seems almost like a miracle. Like how did that happen when it so often doesn't happen in so many other areas? And, you know, I know as a new mother, I got a lot of propaganda, particularly about back sleeping, at quite a few different points, at the hospital, at the pediatrician, at daycare, at schools. Do you have any sense of what worked there and what could be repeated? Or does it seem like it might be a one-off?
So I think one thing is that everyone agreed on that. So I think with many of the kinds of choices we think about in parenting, there is a bit less agreement because the evidence is maybe not as clear cut,
right,
and the effects are not as big. So I think this was a place where once it was recognized that back sleeping was important, the effects on SIDS are actually quite large. And so I think that everybody got behind this. And so then you have, you know, not only the American Academy of Pediatrics and also pediatricians and also daycare providers, but, you know, everybody pushing in the same direction. I think the other thing is it's relatively easy, in the sense that, you know, it is true that babies sleep, actually some babies sleep a bit better on their stomach, but most babies will sleep about as well on their back once they get used to it. So relative to some things in parenting, which are very, very difficult to do, and so it can be hard to get people to do them just because they're very hard, this was something where you've got to choose a direction. You know, we can just tell people to choose this direction instead of this other direction, and they had to choose one of the two. So
you basically had 50-50 odds of compliance before
exactly.
You started the project, right?
Exactly. And so I think that those things kind of all came together in that example. But, you know, it wasn't instantaneous. I mean, it definitely took a few years for that advice to get to get out. And I think once it did, then we saw some reinforcing evidence, for example, SIDS rates falling, which made it even more clear that this was important and pushed people even more to make sure that this was something that people were doing.
Let's talk about a slightly more complicated issue, which I think sort of blurs the lines in almost all of those categories that you just described, which is breastfeeding. This is a place where people have very, very strong feelings. In the cases of breastfeeding mothers, often those feelings are backed by extremely unusual hormone production at that moment, speaking from personal experience at least. And also we have the complicating factors of class and work and government recommendations versus cultural practices. Tell me the story of breastfeeding and the debate as it's emerged for our generation.
So breastfeeding gets just so much emphasis as a new parent. And so I think when you are, you know, first in the hospital, the first thing they do is they come in, they'll be like, okay, like, let's get that top off and stick the baby on there. And you know, it becomes, I think for many women, I mean, myself included, such an important, something that you obsess about almost as sort of like, this is the way to give my baby the best start. And it's very important and it's going to have all kinds of long-term impacts. And I think that gets translated into a tremendous amount of societal pressure that a lot of people feel in the direction of, you know, I have to do this. I have to do it for a long time. If, you know, if I can't do it, I've failed. And I think that, you know, that interacts badly with the fact that for many people, breastfeeding is very hard. It's physically hard to do. It's hard to manage if you have to pump. There's like many aspects of it that are not easy. So in contrast to the back sleeping, where I think it's not too hard, this is something where it is very hard. And I think it is all made more complicated and difficult by this societal pressure, as you say, and people telling you, you know, here are all the like lengthy list of pages and pages of benefits of doing this. So when I did the book, I actually wanted to sort of narrow into like what are the benefits that actually have support in the data, and the reason that that's not necessarily the full list of benefits is that the kinds of women or the types of women who breastfeed are different from on average from women who do not. So breastfeeding is more common in women with more education and women who are richer and women who are married, who have children later. And those maternal characteristics and family characteristics are also associated with some of the good outcomes that are attributed to breastfeeding, like improvements in IQ or lower obesity rates in childhood. So we want to be very careful about that data and not overinterpreting from those correlations. Fortunately, there is some good data. So there's one kind of big randomized trial. It's not perfect, but it is randomized, which means we're more confident about causality. And then there are some very good sibling studies where they compare siblings who were breastfed or not, children born to the same mom. And when you sort of dive into those and kind of try to pull out what's real, there are some benefits of breastfeeding. Probably the most significant is actually a lower risk of breast cancer for the mother. So not about the baby at all. And there are some early life benefits for the baby, maybe a lower risk of diarrhea, gastrointestinal infections, and maybe a little bit of a lower rate of ear infection. But all of these claims about, you know, obesity later and asthma later and allergies later and IQ later, the best data just do not support those links. And so I think when we talk about this, it might be better to be a little bit more realistic with women about, yeah, there are some benefits to this and it would be great if you want to try and maybe you will like it. And it's something a lot of women, you know, feel is a very good thing to have done, but to sort of pile on all these, like all this, you know, fake news about the long-term benefits, I don't think that's helping anybody. I think it's just making people feel bad for no reason.
And yet people have a way of rounding up from what you just described, which is maybe there is a slight benefit if you look at the data in this way to, you got to do it. Like there is a sort of human tendency to take a conditional or a sort of maybe statement and turn it into a thesis statement for whatever position you previously held. Yeah. Did you think about that? I mean, of course you did. I won't even phrase this as a question. I am sure you thought a lot about that when you were writing this book as well as your previous book. You know, not just how can I accurately describe what I see in the data, but also how can I say it in a way that creates the best outcomes or that my readers will be able to digest. Do you have any rules of thumb that you could offer to me as a journalist or to other types of communicators who are using data about how to do that? Because I think your previous book did it really successfully. I mean, this is one reason that women passed that book around to each other was because they were able to hear the message, there's a little benefit or there's a little risk, but basically don't worry about it. And it was, that was often the takeaway.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I think in many of these cases, the key is to try to like let them be less emotionally fraught. And so I think part of what is the value of economics is, you know, people say it's like the dismal science. We're like very serious and not emotional, but I think sometimes that's good in these cases, because as you say, it gets like these choices feel so important that they get very, very wrapped up in our concept of ourself. And it can be very hard to step back and be like, well, you know what? Like, just because I made that choice doesn't mean it's the right choice for everyone. So, you know, once you've invested all this time in breastfeeding and sort of done all this, then you want to be like, yeah, that's really important. Like, that's the most important thing. And because I feel really emotionally, you know, drawn to it and connected to it, and it worked for me, or at least I tried really hard with it. And I think it's hard to step back and say, you know what, that worked for me, and I think that was great, but maybe it's not for everybody. And, you know, it doesn't have these kind of enormous, crazy, crazy benefits. So I think some of the value in these books, I hope, is to give women a little bit of a framework, almost, or families, not just women, a little bit of a framework to think about these choices in a slightly more detached way. So rather than saying, you know, how does breastfeeding make me feel, or don't I want to give my baby the best start, to say, you know what, like, why don't I sit down and think about, you know, what are my preferences here? What do I see as what's going to be possible for me? And let me combine that with some, you know, real knowledge of the evidence. Maybe it's a little bit good, you know, maybe some of these other things are overstated, and then I can make an informed and slightly more detached decision. So, and I think that's good even in these high emotional stakes settings to try to detach a little bit.
So other things that people feel strong emotions about include their own personal financial decisions, also often politics. Do you think that more data in areas where people don't see it as a traditionally emotional space, but it is, could have this same result? That is, you know, you use the phrase fake news sort of in passing there. And I think this is a place that we're seeing kind of an active debate right now about, you know, how do we talk about stuff like what's the right amount of money to spend to mitigate global warming or something like that? And emotions run similarly high, but people have faith that there is an answer somewhere in the numbers. You know, do you think there are parallels, or do you think, you know, I was sort of thinking about your work, and I was going to say, when you deal with less traditionally emotional subjects, do you find this same dynamic? And then I remembered, you know, you basically only write about dead babies. So
I'm high on the emotional balance. I mean, I think that one of the things that happens in all of these settings, I think we have data on this, is often when people see evidence, they interpret it in line with their priors.
Right.
So I think one of the things that happens, probably even more so in these other settings you're talking about than in something like parenting, is like when you are a person who thinks climate change is important or not important or worth spending a lot of money on or not, and when you see evidence on that, you read it through your lens. And in some of these studies on things like the death penalty, showing two different people the same data moves them further apart rather than closer together.
Right.
In terms of their knowledge. Now, I think some of the same things can happen in these, could, you know, I'll be interested to see how people react to some of the things in this book. So I can imagine people who think breastfeeding is important reading this and being like, yeah, the best evidence does show that there are positive impacts, just like I said. Mm-hmm. And I can see people who are, you know, who maybe think that it should be given less weight saying, you know, there it is, like the best evidence shows that the positive impacts are small and that, you know, this isn't as important as people say. And so I can imagine the same kind of dynamics happening here. I'm not sure. Although I think in the case of these parenting choices, I actually think that would be okay. So I think in these public policy debates where we like have to come to one decision, it is problematic if when people see evidence, their decisions move further. In the case of parenting, there is not just one decision. Everybody is going, should be making the decisions that work for their family.
Right.
So
and
if what
not,
happens,
there's not even just one decision per family, right? You can,
right.
You can make a different decision with the next kid.
For different kids. Exactly. So I think if everybody looks at this and they say like, you know, now I'm really confident in my decision to breastfeed or not to breastfeed, and two different people see it and they get more confident in two different decisions, like that's great. That is the main thing I want to do here, is make people happier in the choices that they make and not have so much sort of second guessing about, oh, did I do the right thing?
And the thing that undergirds that idea, like the reason one would even have such a mission for one's book, is if you fundamentally think both of the choices are fine or all 10 of the choices are fine. Are there places in your book where you don't think that's true? Are there topics that you dealt with? I mean, you hit a lot of controversial topics, right? Vaccination and screen time. There's a lot of hot topics in there. So talk to me about where your outer limits are. Where are the places that if someone came out of your book and said thing X is fine, you would think the book had failed?
Yeah, so I think there's probably two. So one is vaccines. You know, I think that the evidence strongly favors vaccinating your kids. I think that the public health ramifications are important. And I think that there is a vast amount of evidence that vaccination is safe. And so I think that's a place where I hope that the book will move people towards people who are on the fence towards vaccines rather than away. And I think that the other piece is spanking. So, I mean, the spanking is actually a complicated topic for me, because I pretty strongly feel that it is not okay on a sort of moral ground, which is actually not a stance I take about almost anything else in the book. And I'm straightforward about this in the book when I say, you know, I'm going to show you what the evidence is, but I want to be clear, this is something where I just don't think it's okay. Mm-hmm. But I do think the evidence does not suggest that is a good method of disciplining your kid. So those are kind of two places where I think that it's more, that it's the data is that I hope that people will come out in a particular way. But those were two pretty small things within a very, very large number of other things where I think, as you say, I think people will come out with different choices, and that's great. And I don't think there's a right decision.
Do you find that message resonates? I mean, with your previous book, did you find that message resonated with people? I ask because I think that message is often unsatisfying in other areas of life. You know, people want the right answer about what they should eat or how much they should exercise or whether they should live in the city or the country. I mean, I don't know, just, you know, I'm trying to think of sort of analogous personal decisions. They want a right answer, and they find actually all of the answers within a certain tolerance are fine to be unsatisfying. But I think with the sort of in the post-mommy wars era, if we can describe that as where we are, maybe people have a demand for that message.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's probably a piece of that. But I think in some sense, this book doesn't say there's no right answer. It just says that your right answer isn't the same as somebody else's right answer.
Right.
I think there is a right answer.
That's true.
For you.
That is. And that was an inexact phrasing. You're right.
There's a right answer for you. It's just not necessarily my right answer.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about a couple of recent papers that you've done, including one that I would love for you to just explain a little bit to me and to our listeners, which was called Behavioral Feedback: Do Individual Choices Influence Scientific Results? And, you know, I think experimental design is hard, or is hard for some set of social sciences in particular. The reproducibility crisis and the sort of general sense that maybe studies don't show what studies show, right, in the sort of headline parlance. Talk about your work kind of understanding that, and in particular in this study, this sort of feedback loop that you're describing.
Yeah, so I got interested in this, I think, precisely because of writing these books.
Right.
So there are a lot of choices in parenting and pregnancy where it's hard to learn whether something is really causing and something else, because the kind of people who engage in different choices are different. And so this paper kind of draws on that, although it's in the context of nutrition or health choices, I guess. Mm-hmm. So the basic idea here is that these kind of what we'd say formally, like these biases, these correlations are themselves a product of changes in recommendations. So the sort of simple example I give is, let's say that that a new study comes out that says that, you know, pineapple is really good for preventing heart attacks. And we can imagine, like, that could just be an accident. Like, statistics sometimes just makes a mistake. And so it could just be a what we call a false positive. But what might happen then is a bunch of people read that study in the New York Times or JAMA or wherever, and they say, oh, I should start eating pineapple. But like, what are the kinds of people that start eating pineapple? It's also people who are really concerned about their heart, and they're probably doing other stuff, exercising, not smoking, eating a lot of kale, whatever it is. And so what we call the selection, the kind of people who are eating pineapple become sort of more healthy people in general. If you come back later to study that again, you might find that the effect is even bigger, that it looks like pineapple is even better for heart attacks than it was before, because now the kind of people who are eating the pineapple are really even more different. And so the paper is about whether that actually happens in the world. And so I use data on vitamins and diet, and indeed you really see these kind of dynamic selection patterns. So probably the starkest is like the case of sugar. So sugar is something where, you know, it used to be that like fat was bad and, you know, sugar was not as bad. And so actually in the late 80s, if you look at the relationship between sugar and education, you see that people who are more educated actually eat sort of more sugar than people who are less educated.
Definitely checks out with my personal experience as an 80s
absolutely.
Child.
Yeah, I mean, as I remember the day that they were like, don't eat eggs, eat like Cocoa Puffs. I mean, you had this is a complete breakfast. It was like Cocoa Krispies and like some toast
and like
jam.
A huge glass of orange juice.
Enormous glass of orange juice. And then, of course, over time, they were like, oh, just kidding. Sugar is the worst, you know, and that kind of became a thing. And so now if you look in the most recent data, eating more sugar is associated with lower education. And that also shows up in weight. So actually in this early 80s period, it was the thinner people who were having more sugar. And now it's people who are heavier who are having more sugar. So the kind of point of the paper is like in some ways a little destructive, I guess. It just sort of says like, look, these problems are really big and make it very hard to learn about these kind of relationships in this what we call observational data because of these biases.
And what's the way out?
Paper kind of punts on that, that's because I need to have other papers to write later. I think one answer is randomized trials would be better in these settings. I think another answer is that we could do more in this space to try to improve the ways that we're analyzing observational data. So thinking more carefully about causality and not just putting in a few confounding adjustments and kind of calling it a day, that there may be more sophisticated things we can do. But I think ultimately I don't sort of come down on a solution.
Another paper that I wanted to talk about is the provocatively named Does Disease Cause Vaccination? And I mostly want to talk about this paper because of your incredibly sassy abstract for this thing, where you say, so you're describing the fact that when there are disease outbreaks, vaccination rates seem to go up.
Yes.
And you say, I find that pertussis outbreaks in a county decrease the share of unvaccinated children entering kindergarten. These responses do not reflect changes in future diseases risk. I argue that these facts are best fit by a model in which individuals are both myopic and irrational. Just so sassy. Let's talk about this. Individuals are myopic and irrational.
Yes, sure. So I think what I meant there, I was not intending to be sassy, although when you read it in that voice, it is sassy.
I mean, I did. I brought a little bit of a voice acting to it.
Yeah, a little sass. Yeah. So I think what I'm trying to say there is, is that this, so what I see in that paper, as you say, is that when there is a disease outbreak, people then sort of subsequently vaccinate. And the effects are very short-lived. So it's basically like if there's an outbreak kind of when you're making this choice, so like either like when the kid is born or right before they go to school, which are kind of two flashpoints for when you would be interacting with this decision, those outbreaks are the thing that matter. And so a rational person could, in this model, choose not to vaccinate their kid if they felt the cost was very high. But if they've chosen that, they then should not react to like the fact that there's three pertussis cases, because the fact that there's three pertussis cases actually contains no information about whether there's going to be future pertussis cases. So basically, it seems like people are kind of going along. I mean, my sort of overinterpretation, which I didn't put in the abstract, is that, you know, people are kind of going along thinking, oh, well, like nobody gets pertussis, so that's not such a big deal. And then all of a sudden, when you go to the doctor in the summer before the kid is going to kindergarten, the doctor's like, by the way, do you want to get this pertussis vaccine? Let me tell you that, like, in our county this year, 11 kids have gotten pertussis. And then people are like, oh, I guess pertussis is a disease that people get. I should vaccinate my kid. So I think that's kind of the interpretation that I have.
And that same dynamic where parents overestimate risk of rare occurrences is also at the root of a lot of concern, for instance, about child kidnapping. This, you know, if you see a report on the news, you then are spurred to action to minimize the risk of kidnapping. Unlike the vaccination result, it's not clear that those parental actions are always utility maximizing.
Yeah, I think people definitely react to anecdote, which is something that the anti-vaccination community has used pretty effectively, and I think the other side could probably use effectively also.
Yeah. So you've written in this book about very young children. So this is as you said, up to 3 years old. This means, you know, for the most part, these are kids who are full time in the care of an adult. This is not yet the go out and play kid for the most part. What is your guidance, or what are your findings about what you can know about your kid by the time they're three? Because I think this is another thing that parents talk a lot about. They say, oh, he talked early. He's going to be a great orator. He walked early. He's going to be a football player. Is any of that information contained in the meeting or missing of early milestones?
Yeah, I was laughing because I think my son is a good rhymer, and so the other day I was like maybe he'll be these rhymes are amazing. He'd probably be a poet, you know. And then I was stepped back. I was like, wait a minute, like, you know, it is true he's great at rhyming, but this is probably not, it's probably an overinterpretation, but it's very hard, right, when it's your kid, you have all these like ideas. So the answer is sort of broadly, these are not these kind of early milestone things are not super predictive of the future. So on sort of physical stuff, there's basically almost no predictive power unless your kid is way outside of the norm. So, you know, of course, some kids have physical disabilities, but if you're saying, you know, my kid didn't walk until 15 months, but, you know, somebody else's kid walked at 9 months, like, does that mean that their kid is going to be, you know, an Olympic soccer player, or my kid's going to be last on the kickball team? Like, there just isn't, we don't have any evidence that those things are correlated or any particular reason to think that they are. On something like language development, you know, it is true that, like, on average, kids who speak much more slowly, sort of on the way at the bottom of the distribution, is true on average. They do a bit worse on tests, kind of later in the later in life. But the predictive power of that is really, really low. So if you sort of had this idea that, like, somehow you were gonna sort of take the bottom 10% of kids and say, like, you know, are they going to be in the bottom 10% when they're in eighth grade? You know, the answer is they'd be slightly more likely, but almost all of them would not be in the bottom 10%. So I think that kind of, there's like a sort of reassurance there that basically these things are, you know, yeah, there's a little bit of a predictive power, but they're not deterministic at all. So, you know, like in either direction. So if your kid is a genius who is great at rhyming, it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be winning poetry awards. except maybe my kid.
Well, your kid, I'm sure, is destined to be a poet.
And actually, bad guy rhymes.
I want you to like come back to this interview later when he receives his first, you know, contract to publish his his collected works, and you can say, "I knew it."
I knew it then.
So I just want to kind of close up by asking some bigger questions about when and where there is an opportunity to change behavior for the good at the individual level. Because I think, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, the right thing for you is not necessarily the right thing for me, but there are boundaries on it. And also that I think, you know, obviously I am the editor of a political magazine, and so I spend most of my time thinking about how incentives are applied at the level of a whole population or at the level of, you know, at the level of politics. What lessons did you learn from your first book about the kind of information people can hear or want to hear? And you know, what do you think is the thing in this new book that is most likely to change practices, at least among the demographic of humans who are likely to consume Emily Oster books?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that it is generally hard to change people's behavior. I think this sort of space presents an opportunity for a lot of behavior change, because it is a time when people are making a lot of choices and going through a lot of sort of forced changes anyway. And so, so sort of getting to them and suggesting that they do something different, is, I think, you know, is useful. And I, you know, I think on the first book, you know, my guess is that I had some, you know, substantial impact on like whether people ate sushi, but probably very little impact on like whether people got an epidural. You know, and to be fair, I didn't recommend anything in particular on the epidural, but I think on sort of, there are some things that you're kind of more committed to and some things which maybe you're less committed to or didn't have much of a prior, or maybe you like sushi. You know, on the new book, it's an interesting question. What are the things I think people like will?
What's the sushi of the new book and what's
the
epidural?
What's the sushi of the new book? You know, I don't think there's anything quite like that in here. You know, my guess is that the thing that people will find the most reassuring is the stuff about sleep training, where I sort of argue that, that there's simply no evidence that sleep training is bad. And I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people end up doing, but often end up feeling bad about. And mm-hmm. so I think that this sort of evidence here is likely to be reassuring for a lot of parents. I think that in terms of things that people will not, you know, will probably not change their behavior very much, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Maybe you can only know after the fact.
I think the studies will
do individual choices influence your book's results?
Right.
I don't know.
No, exactly. I mean, I would go back and like study whether my book is influencing people. You know, I think part of it with these books is like it's always sort of surprising what people pick up on and what they're interested in. And it wasn't in the first book, it wasn't always the stuff that I thought was the most surprising. And we'll see here.
The other question, I guess, or the other way to phrase it is, was there anything that you changed midstream based on your research as you were working on this book? Was there anything that you did,
yes,
did differently?
Yes, there was. I mean, there was one sort of significant thing, which is that when I wrote the toddler discipline chapter, I actually had not intended to have that in the book. And my editor said, you know, can you please like write a chapter on discipline? I want to know if these systems like 1-2-3 magic are effective. And so I did the research for that. And I think the answer was basically, yes, there's some good evidence behind some of these kind of systems that emphasize consistency in discipline. And I use that in my own parenting practice. That was like the one big thing for me that I did not expect that was because of the book.
And do you think that your baseline expectation that there wasn't going to be good evidence, like where did that come from?
I'm not sure. I think I just thought this was, you know, with a lot of these sort of older kid questions, things like screen time, you know, the evidence just isn't, it isn't very good. Mm-hmm. And so it had not occurred to me that this would be a place where actually we had some good randomized evidence.
Right. So it's literally sort of the discovery of a cache of good studies that
exactly.
that was the deciding
surprise.
Factor.
Yeah.
Where is the next cache of good studies hiding? Or put differently, your next book's totally going to be about food, right?
It's funny. I think if I wrote another book, it would be about food. Let me leave it with that. I think if I write another book, it will be about food.
I was trying to read the tea leaves, I guess, to lean too hard into the metaphor. looking at some of your tweets and your current work, and it certainly seems like the rebuttal of the rebuttal of the rebuttal of whether eggs are good or bad. It was like some very rich.
Yes,
potential.
It was like back and forth. Yeah, the eggs are they're in and out of
right.
fashion.
And just for our listeners' benefit, that new study that says actually eggs are bad doesn't actually say eggs are bad.
That is not what that study says.
Right.
That study says that like I interpret that study as saying that like eating a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich every morning from McDonald's is bad for you.
Breaking news.
Breaking news.
Details at 11. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me. And your new book is out on April 23rd. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. It is available wherever fine books are sold, as they say in the commercials.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.